Bob Marley with Guiltiness is from his legendary 1977 album, Exodus. This is Lead Stories. I'm Retrice Lead. And what a weekend we had that forced us to deal with what is current and transported us back to a time, an era in American history that we should never forget. Well, I'm talking, of course, about Charlottesville. And in Charlottesville, we saw the bold expression of hate. We saw the sides of America that we always are told no longer exist, that they're gone forever, never to return. We've grown up as a nation. We've gone through several decades of reform and enlightenment, and we therefore are much better off for it. And it's all about moving ahead. Those dark days are behind us. And we are more aware than ever of our personal responsibility to keep advancing and helping the country as a whole to keep advancing, to evolve into a more humane, more purposeful nation in which we are a lot clearer about where we should be focusing our attention. But of course, we saw that very, very close to the skin is a very, very ugly America. It remains ugly. And it remains intentionally ugly. People refusing to change. People refusing to honor their fellow citizens. Just with basic manners. This weekend cost three people their lives in Charlottesville, Virginia. A participant in one of the groups trying to or screaming for attention about the way life is lived in that part of the world in Charlottesville, Virginia. Her name was Heather Heyer. She was 32 years old. And she was trying to create a change. She was trying to make this ugliness go away. Instead, she lost her life. Her friends remember that she would often say, "If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention." Consider the profundity of that. If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. And she and many, many others were outraged that white supremacists, white racists, devoted ugly people, devoted to being ugly, descended on the town of Charlottesville to make sure that people understand that all of this clamoring for peace and justice and harmony and cooperation and all of the traits that we supposedly hold so dear, that we should understand we are under the charge of white power still. The country is under control by white power that has no intentions of going away and has every intention of propagating and maintaining white power. That, they swear, is not going to change. Even if they have to kill you for it, to impress upon you that point. And this kind of ignorance comes in many flavors and many degrees of just plain stupidity and willful, calculated ignorance. So along with being stupid and ignorant, they're also vengeful and violent. And I dare say, from what we witnessed over the weekend, they are aided and abetted by a large sector of the local population, wherever they go to behave this way. They know better than most people, after all, where they are likely to get strong support for their repulsive beliefs and actions. But we had a combination of effort in Charlottesville, Virginia. We had several people of like mind, if one could stretch one's imagination to believe that they have minds at all. But there was a show of force, both in terms of the numbers and in the aggression. The issue that brought these people together, because there were people like that on one side, and there were people like Heather Heyer on the other side of the same issue. And they wanted, after a long period of acrimony, they were hoping that somewhere they would find support for respect for each other, for the rights of individuals, yes, to express your thoughts, but not with mowing people down, running them over, threatening them by the sheer numbers of your assembly, and openly displaying the signs, the historical signs, of intended further violence. I'm talking about the torches of the old South. A symbol that there was going to be big trouble and they would be the ones causing it. It was a disgrace. It did not strike fear as they might have wanted. It stirred in the nation a strong current of disgust. Even the so-called our leader, I don't want to claim him at all, was spectacularly inert. He didn't have the courage to go there and stand them down or send troops, as he likes to do. Send some troops in to restore order and to protect the innocent. Instead, he blamed them while he told the nation how sorry he was to have witnessed such a cataclysmic deterioration of law and order that we also should learn and remember, we the public, that this was something of the people's own making, not his. He has nothing to do with it. This is a prime example of what happens when there is no law and order. People revert to primal behaviors. But don't look to him and wag a finger of blame. He's not part of this tragedy in Charlottesville, Virginia. Just to give a little picture here of what is said to be the root problem of the weak end of shame. Shame, just plain shame. The town of Charlottesville had been wrestling with a very touchy and sensitive problem for some time. They decided, or they were to decide, but the idea had been broached in this heavily racist town. The idea had been broached to honor Robert E. Lee, the great Confederate general who is spoken throughout the South, spoken of in very, very laudatory terms. He's greatly admired. General Robert E. Lee, who played a major role in the South at a time of pitched battles between the North and South over the question of slavery. Well, of course, he was pro-slavery. And because he fought, physically fought, to maintain slavery in the South, he's a hero to those who also wanted to maintain forever slavery in the South. But of course, you don't live forever. And so General Lee died. But of course, his memory must live on. He is and was, after all, a hero in the South. And so the idea came up that he should be honored with a statue, a kind of memorial in memory of the great things, the heroic things he did to maintain racial control in the South. The control of whites, any whites, over blacks, all blacks. Well, it proceeded. The idea took shape and form, and the statue, after the original creator of the statue had died, they managed to get another person to complete the statue. Now the question is where to put it. Because, you know, times had changed, we were told. And the statue had to be placed in a prominent area, prominently placed, and Jackson will continue, I mean, Robert E. Lee will continue to live. Then it started getting a little touchy because the African Americans in the town, who also have a historical memory, didn't want that statue publicly displayed at all. They felt it was an insult. And they felt that the historical record would have corroborated that. And they did not want to live every day staring at a statue of a man who they believed was a war criminal, among other things, and who singularly elevated the wrong values, the wrong history, and promoted white supremacy. So you have one group totally bent on honoring this man, and you have another group saying this is a daily insult, not just to our intelligence, but it should be considered a daily insult to any decent American. The concession was made that the local city council will think it over and figure out what to do. They never had the chance to finalize this very thing, to decide finally, although the initial vote was on the side of people who said the statue should be removed, period. Because it is such an affront to all citizens of conscience, whether you're white or black, the statue should be removed. But the local courts said, just to make sure we do the right thing the right way, we will have a cooling off period and we will make a final decision. Well, they never did get to enact the final decision because this kind of behavior intervened in the meantime. You have people coming from other places taking sides and feeling obligated, whichever side they took, feeling obligated to make their presence known. So a major march was planned for this weekend by one of the racist groups, and they planned a big thing to impress people that they have the numbers. They have, therefore, the power and the might to get their way. They don't have to conduct further discussions on this matter. They believed it was settled a long time ago, when, in fact, Robert E. Lee was actually alive. They thought way back then this should have happened. And the city would honor one of its most prominent racist fathers. And of course, as with everything else, you have more and more people coming together taking the opposite opinion. They were a multiracial, diverse group who said, look, if it comes to the point where this city is going to be divided again, where we are going to be thrown back again into turmoil, if it comes to that, it's not worth it. But we have to make a stand because the subtext of all of this, it's not really about a statue. We know you love yourself some Robert E. Lee, we know that. But the real intent here is to force the issue and to force a decision that most of the people in the town did not like or did not want to make. But they were of a mind that the statue caused an inordinate amount of pain for too many people in the city. Every day as they see that statue or pass that statue, they have to remember that a long time ago their status in life was decided by this man. And he encouraged the growth of the Ku Klux Klan and other terrorist groups. People died. People were denied opportunities. People had a very hard time just controlling their emotions over this issue. And so they were looking forward to solving this problem in a way that everybody could see the logic of it. But this gave the national racist groups a chance to express or to give the illusion of their power and might, extending beyond the city, but extending nationally. They had such power that they could summon up the affiliated groups to come and begin a race war in Charlottesville. And that is why people were assembling there to call them out and to bring to the attention of the nation what was about to happen. That's why Heather Heyer was there, and friends, and people of all dispositions found it necessary to put on the record that this is a time of life and an attitude of life in America that needs to be discontinued by the people offended by these things. As she said, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. So as they gathered and the other folks gathered, the white supremacists, they call themselves white supremacists. What are you supreme about, really? The racists, they gathered too. And at a critical moment, it escalated. Suddenly it escalated, where a young man in his early 20s literally drove his car into the growing mass of people, demonstrating whether on one side or the other. And then things really got out of hand. So there was no turning back. There was no easy way to turn this back. Heather is killed. This guy had the intention, obviously, of scoring much higher on the kill rate, but only one person was killed. He might have wanted to emulate the terror tactics that we've seen in London and in other places where someone drives a vehicle into the thickest part of a crowd, hoping to kill the maximum number of people, kill and maim and hurt the maximum number of people. It was an attempt but it nonetheless claimed life and caused injury to several others who had to be treated at local hospitals. Two others were killed as well. They were police officers assigned to a helicopter unit that was ordered to observe the crowd from the helicopter. We still don't know what exactly happened there, but we know that two police officers also were killed in connection with this outrageous gathering. And several people were hurt pretty badly. They're still hospitalized and they are recuperating. They're being fixed up, patched up. Others have already been released. But that's the way they chose to express, I'm talking about these racist groups, they chose to express their opinions and their authority that way. The president, the commander-in-chief, took pretty long to say anything about this. And when he did, he talked about the fact that so many actors in this scenario bore direct blame for what happened over the weekend. He never singled out any of the terror groups. He never discussed this as an act of terror, which it was. Hours went by, and then we got a pretty feeble expression of sorrow from his daughter, who said something to the point of, "This is not American." You know, they always say the very violence that they've been accustomed to and that they've initiated year after year in so many places around the world and around the country, suddenly it's intolerable. Well, there you go. But only until, I believe it was yesterday, did we hear from the president and his elaborated statement was that, you know, this is not the America that we know, but, and there's great sorrow and concern about how things ended up. But at the same time, people ought to understand that several people are responsible for what happened. That's how he saw it, and that's how he continues to see it. There was no way to determine, well, okay, let's say several people were actors in this event. Well, we did see clearly that there could be blame because we saw it. We saw who the actors were, for the most part, agitating and trying to stoke a fight, trying to bring everything down to the close common denominator. We saw that. So that is how he believes he gets away by looking presidential, because he's commenting on a pretty tragic situation. And yet he escapes what one would consider to be a necessary part of the process. You have access to film footage. You have access to all the news reports and what they're saying. Certainly, you can determine from the preliminary information, you clearly can determine who played the largest role in stoking these fires. But he says nothing. about that. He says that many people, there were many actors in this tragedy, and it should never happen again. Well, okay, people will remember that. Now, the President of the United States could make no definitive determination as to what the heck happened there in Charlottesville, Virginia, over the weekend, and who is primarily responsible. So we're going to talk about that today. And I want to know from you, your thoughts on what does a situation like this tell us about the state of affairs in the United States at the most basic level? What does it say about this concept of democracy and the lofty ideals that we extol when we add so many other things to this notion of democracy and fairness and whatnot, when the very situation is telling us that we don't have a clue? We are in very serious denial about the state of affairs, current state of affairs, and whether it is possible to hold on to the hope that things could get better, or whether it should absolutely bring us to the point of reckoning on a racial basis, because the evidence, there's plenty of evidence on that basis, so that you could make a determination now as to how you go forward or how the country goes forward. Do we still hold on to this silly idea that we are a country, that we share high ideals? Or do we come to terms with the fact that we must see to our own survival as a beleaguered people, and that there is a permanent class, if you will, with its own permanent philosophy, that under no circumstances will it accept members of other groups as their equals, at the very least. And so we should stop wasting time with these silly pursuits of equality and begin to articulate for ourselves, those of us who feel put upon by people who arbitrarily decide to take control of this country on the basis of race, to hold themselves as superior in every way to all others. Because now we have to regard this not just as a philosophy, but this is now the undergirding, the psychological undergirding for this cleavage that we have in society, and we have had it for hundreds of years. Do we dispense, do we throw out any possibility of a healing here? Because it is hard to be both victim and healer. Should a choice be made? Should we redefine these people? Not only are they racists, but are they also terrorists? We also have to deal with the question of what do we teach children Do we teach them the reality that, in fact, in many places in the United States, it's a day-by-day thing? It's a gamble. Life is a gamble. Simply because you're black or brown or Asian. And now we come to the nitty-gritty. This is a conversation we need to have, and we need to be resolute about it. We can't afford to waste any time in denial and in wanting this country to be a healthy place to live. We shouldn't be put in the position of wanting that more than everybody else. So what do we do? We'll take this short break, and we will come directly to your thoughts at 888-874-4888 right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. Your calls now at 888-874-4888. What does getting real about our situation require of us? Starting with Clay in New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hello, you three. This is Clay. I'm calling you again. Hello.
Yes, I'm listening.
Hello again, and I want to offer that the late great Al Lewis used to say that racism in this country is in the weave of the cloth. Okay, and the thing is, what I teach my children is that not every black man that you meet is your brother, and not every white man that you meet is your enemy. Ultimately, also progressive mind, what we need to do is get prepared, because these people, these clowns, are very well prepared. Okay? And that's what we need to do. We need to wake up and prepare ourselves.
What does that mean?
By whatever means necessary. Because I was reading the paper yesterday, and it basically, the article that I read, basically, they state that, yeah, these people are very well prepared, and the people that were counter-protesting were not prepared. And ultimately, that's what I see.
You see, I'll argue that point. It appears that they are prepared, but really they're not. They give the illusion, and they have been successful at conditioning the rest of us to believe that when you say that they are prepared, that they're prepared monetarily, they're prepared psychologically, they're prepared economically. No, they're not. They're just crazy. And they've been successful at intimidating us. They've been successful at intimidating the rest of us. So we take a step away to try and avoid them. That's because we are inclined toward peace. They are not. They have a whole different agenda. Our agendas are not the same.
That is correct. But usually, if you look at history, Nazi Germany, the right wing has always had some level. They are prepared basically to do violence. That's what they're prepared to do. But ultimately, you have to take the you have to make the moves so you're prepared to meet that violence. You know, unfortunately, yes. We are of a progressive mind do not do that. You know, that's what I see.
The thing is, we do not have enough faith in our philosophy. We don't want to kill anybody. We don't want to cause trouble. And their philosophy is entirely different. Their philosophy is, if I have to kill you in order to control you and in order to control other people's minds about my power, hey, it's a done deal. They have entirely different dispositions, psychological dispositions. They cannot rationally argue their points.
No, they can't. They're ignorant.
So their minds are not working. And in the meantime, we surrender ourselves because we don't believe in war. We don't believe in killing people. We don't believe in being unfair to people and so forth. So that's a dilemma. What do we do? Do we have an obligation, is the question. Do you have an obligation of a person with a different mindset but unable to escape being hounded by people who are going to come for you?
My personal experience has been that when you show the possibility of being violent, people leave you alone. Okay? That's what has worked for me. Hello?
Well, yes, I can see where people would think that that is a logical way to go. But it doesn't bring us any closer to what you would consider to be a rational decision. It requires you to step away from your values in order to be or to feel secure.
Thanks for calling in.
Thank you for calling in today. Elizabeth from D.C., you're on the air. Well, not there.
I am of the opinion that the statues should remain and that factual placards should be created that would reflect real historical information regarding all the figures. You know, Thomas Jefferson was the father of X number of slaves and sold off X number of children and left them disinherited. The Lee, responsible for, or was mainly supported by the Ku Klux Klan, responsible for the lynchings and the stealing of land from blacks and oversaw the exploitation of blacks. I mean, you know, they should be factual, not whitewashed.
But the problem with that is not going to solve the problem.
And why
waste money on doing something like that? If people want
because
to do that, let them do that.
Money,
but should
but it's,
public
it's
tax dollars
to a,
go towards something like that?
It's less money to put up a factual placard that would reflect the total or the real history of the individual than it is to remove the artifact and then have it stored indefinitely, where you have to pay storage, you have to pay oversight, you have to pay guards, versus creating a nice new bronze placard that literally and historically correctly reflects what that individual is truly about. And stop whitewashing American history.
Well, that's an idea. I don't know how well that would be embraced, but I mean, it's a very good idea.
Yeah, I mean, Americans don't want to see themselves, and they don't know themselves. White Americans don't want to see their history, honestly, and they don't know their history.
But you get into a whole new problem. That is not going to go away. The question would be, who decides what ought to be known about any given person? Somebody's going to come up with the idea that this is, you're defaming people. And it's going to create an unending cycle of lawsuits and so forth. The fact is, we have to confront this situation. And the progressive community is so, in a sense, so unwilling to engage. Very unwilling to engage. By that, I don't mean that you go out tomorrow and buy yourself a Smith & Wesson. I mean that they would rather show up and, you know, protest for an hour or two and think that that has changed things. It hasn't, and it won't. So we have to figure out what is an appropriate way, an effective way to get things done. Well, you gave us an idea. So maybe we should take a look at that.
Yeah, excuse me. And one last thing, though, regarding the issue of the progressives being unwilling or not yet addressing the issue, a lot of it has to do with the fact that they still have not acknowledged the value of their whiteness and what it allows for them.
Absolutely.
And so having a factual placard that may not be as complimenting as people would like to imagine an individual, but that would be based on historical facts that are documented and verifiable, could be a step towards honestly recognizing the history of the country.
Well, I think you've started a big conversation. It's not going to end today.
No.
But it is merely a start, and I think we should pursue that, put that in the pot and see how people react to it. But thank you so much for offering it today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Jay from New York, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, Eutrice. How are you today?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Good, thank you. It just seems that what happened in Virginia shows many different things. It shows that the country is more divided than one thinks. It shows that people are basically not prepared to deal with the violence. It also shows that you have someone in the office who's supposed to be the head of the country that is not equipped to deal with the subject matter or the situation at all, based on, I don't know if it's his fear of the alt-right, Breitbart, or whoever else you want to call those wingnuts. And then you have people like the woman who just called in who said that it's all right to keep up these monuments as long as you put some sort of historical fact next to it to question the validity of it. The bottom line is the validity of it is that it's totally racist, that the history of this country is never fully told, and it will never be fully told. That's why you have people like these guys who protested, because they want to preserve, as they say, America and what it is. And unfortunately, most people in America doesn't understand what America is, what it's about, how it was created, and where it's going. And we look to think and feel as though we're going to be an inclusive society, but we're never going to be an inclusive society. The thing is, we don't want to accept the fact that this is a white man's country, and that it's a white man's country because basically they built it, they control it, they dictate how every other ethnic group in this country is able to live, perform, act, feed, clothe, and do all the basic necessities to survive. Until we as a people figure out a way how we're going to be able to fend for ourselves or place ourselves in a position to survive the onslaught that could come upon ourselves, we're going to always be in this position. Because remember, those people that were out there protesting, if you look at a lot of them, are your coworkers. Those people are the ones who you would not imagine that they would be supporting these type of things. And to think you're sitting right next to them going to school and you're at work with them and you're oblivious to the fact that they will kill you at the drop of the dime to preserve what they call America.
Well, that's what Bob Marley just sang about. He said that those in power will do anything to preserve their position in society and the power they imagine that they have as a result of that. Thank you, Jay, for your call. Let's talk with Jay from Georgia. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. Yeah, how are you?
Fine. I'm sure someone, I'm hanging in.
Okay. That's great. I'm sure someone has said this maybe earlier today because I didn't catch all of your show. But I've been thinking basically that if the mass media, for example, were to change their programming with the commercials and their news and all that, they could have a big impact on this climate today pretty quickly. But obviously, that's not self-serving. It's not going to be useful for the people that want to remain in power, but maybe perhaps boycotts or certain things could be organized. I'm just saying, to put pressure on the media with their on their programming. Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, these thoughts have been expressed many, many times. And it's the luck of the draw whether, you know, people adopt or buy into them so that they have a positive effect. But in the end, it's about what degree of responsibility is each person willing to take for communal, or I should say, the whole, for everybody in the group to benefit from. So we, by the way, we're continuing this discussion tomorrow because we have, it seems to me, we have to be definitive about what it is we do. We have to be definitive about it. Thank you, Jay from Georgia. Thanks for calling in. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air, and I'm afraid you have a short...
Hello. I don't know how much time I have.
You have about 3 minutes.
Doesn't look like a lot of time. You know, I look at this somewhat differently. To me, I heard Gary talk recently about playing game and whatnot, you know, just like the title of my book, Playing the Game. When I look at this, the type of violence and the things that happen down in Virginia, that is routine. That happens all the time, all over the United States and through the United States history. What is important, I think, that we all should look at is who benefits the most from this. And as I see it, the ones who benefit most from this are at the oligarchy level, the corporations and the people that run this place for this type of thing to go on. Because if you're a small group of people at the Everest of the society, the oligarchs that run America, and you have millions and millions of people, you have to have a way of controlling them. So in this case, in the case of the United States of America, they develop a system, and some of us who do our homework will see this system was developed to have the people who create the wealth by doing work in the society, using the resources that are available, contend with each other. So you have to have a system, for example, of this taxonomy they use of color-coding people, white, black, yellow, red, and so forth, which is an invention. And you have to have these people contending against each other to call attention away from who benefits the most in this society. And that's very clear for anyone that studies, that you'll see that maybe 1% of the people have maybe 40% of the wealth in the country. So you have to have the other people who are doing the work and providing the wealth for those rich people to get the attention away from them and talk about little poor little white people, so-called, white supremacists or Nazis and so forth, and have them fighting with all the other people. And you give them a little extra because you're doing it on phenotypes. So you at the ruling class at the top, you have the white European type of phenotype. So you have other people who are not in your class or category, and but they have the same phenotype, so you give them a little extra, and you have all the groups, whites, blacks, Latinos, Mexicans, everyone fighting in the various ethnic groups. You have them all contending against each other. That's how you run this place.
I believe you're pointing out something very important here, but we're going to do this all week until we get some kind of a definitive answer to the question, because I think
I got
the question,
answers.
The basic...
I'm waiting.
We're talking about this because the question becomes now, it seems to me, to those people who believe themselves to be oppressed by a system, how far are they willing to go to defend their essential humanity? If the idea is that the system is not doing it, the neighborhood isn't doing it, the social and political groups that we belong to aren't doing it, then what is the choice? That's the question we should be answering, understanding the racism of our society as a critical element in how it's run. We had total chaos yesterday. And if you look at being apart from the, you know, the regular speeches that are made, and now they're sending them out on Twitter, you did not have a systemic response. There was no systemic response to systemic craziness that went on yesterday. But my time is running out, has run out, and we will continue this tomorrow. And we will get to the central questions that even we are avoiding. Thanks so much for your calls today. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Meditations and Molotovs with Vincent Emanuele. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. And we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.